More people checked in at the unemployment office last week.
And the U.S. bought more stuff from other countries than it sold.
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for joining us for the podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, the 10th day of March. Coming up, the European debt crisis is back with a vengeance. We're going to hear from Stephen Beard in London. And for one congressman, it pays to be poor in reputation. All that straight ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
A couple of economic indicators starting us off today.
More people applied for first-time jobless benefits last week. The Labor Department says initial claims were up by 26,000 to just under 400,000. Now, some economists say that means the labor market is still in recovery mode.
The government also reported today that the nation's trade deficit has gotten wider. The trade deficit is the discrepancy between how much in goods the U.S. buys from other countries and how much it produces and sells to other countries. It buys way more.
And a surprise from China, Jeremy. The country today said it bought more goods from around the world than it sold. China today recorded its first trade deficit in almost a year, more than $7 billion. It's the country's biggest trade deficit in 7 years. Does that mean China's super fast growth rate is slowing down? Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz is with us from Shanghai. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Steve.
So the Chinese bought more stuff from outside the country than they sold. That story doesn't sound right.
Yeah, it usually goes the other way around. I mean, China's exports were down considerably last month. And here's something new. This winter, we've seen imports to China rising steadily. And that's proof that Chinese consumers are buying more cars, more gas to fuel those cars, more iPads, more of everything. And that's a good sign for American companies hoping to do more business in China. The flip side of this news for the U.S. is that it's going to be more difficult for politicians in Washington to criticize China for an undervalued currency if China continues to narrow that trade gap with the U.S. But whether or not China will continue to see a trade deficit is still an open question because there's a big caveat. This data was from February, the month of the Lunar New Year.
So, all right. So the holiday is big enough to shift an economic indicator like this?
This one is. The Chinese spent most of February celebrating the New Year. So economists think one of the reasons we didn't see much export activity was because the factories here were empty. Everyone went home, but apparently they had time to shop. But the bottom line is that we'll know a lot more next month when the numbers from March come out.
All right. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz from Shanghai. Rob, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, one thing on the agenda in Washington today will be an unusual twist on the light bulbs we use. A Senate committee will consider a Republican proposal to repeal the new standards that have us transitioning to energy-efficient bulbs. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
5 years ago, President George W. Bush signed a law that set a new bar for light bulbs, just as other laws had done for home appliances.
Refrigerators, clothes washers, toilets.
Kateri Callahan leads the Alliance to Save Energy.
Do we want to go back to the refrigerators of the 1970s that were smaller, that didn't work as well, and used about 75% more energy? I don't think so. And why would we want to do it on light bulbs?
She says incandescent bulbs don't make sense. You know how they get hot to the touch? That's 90% of the bulb's energy being wasted. Under the current law, bulbs have 2 years to perform better or they'll get phased out. The Bulb Act would keep inefficient lights on store shelves. A surprising opponent to the Bulb Act, the lighting industry. Fred Haber runs Eastern Energy Services.
This is government regulation that was sorely needed, which also creates jobs.
Jobs in research, engineering, and manufacturing, as companies like his have invested in new lighting technology. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
German automaker Volkswagen says its profit shot up big time in the last 3 months to about $4.5 billion. And European aerospace giant EADS says it has swung back to a profit after its plane maker Airbus saw a pickup in sales around the world last year.
There are more numbers, lots more numbers. Inside what section, Jeremy?
The numbers section.
The numbers section.
Marketplace.org.
Yeah. You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, the 10th day of March. I'm Steve Chiotakis. You can follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. I'm on Twitter as well, at Jeremy Hobson. Now let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world? Today, Spain's credit rating was downgraded yet again. Remember, Greece took a ratings hit earlier this week as well. Well, last year, the European debt crisis almost threw the U.S. into a double-dip recession. So are we at risk of the same thing now? Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us from London with more. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So I thought this problem was cooling off.
No, it's hotting up again. I mean, the trouble with debt, if you don't pay it off, it doesn't go away. And some governments and households and companies in the Eurozone, in countries like Portugal, Ireland, Greece and Spain, borrowed so heavily during the boom that there's now serious doubt they'll be able to repay the money. That raises some very uncomfortable choices. Governments can default, or they can be bailed out by taxpayers in richer countries, or they can ask for debts to be written off, which puts the banks which lent the money in jeopardy. So some very difficult choices Europe is grappling with right now.
And Stephen, why could this be such a problem on this side of the Atlantic?
Well, if this crisis deepens, it could definitely harm the U.S. in a number of ways. But perhaps the most significant, according to Simon Tilford of the Center for European Reform, would be the effect on the U.S. dollar.
One thing you probably would see if the Eurozone went into a renewed period of crisis would be a steep fall in the value of the euro and a corresponding rise in the value of the dollar.
A more expensive dollar would make American goods and services more expensive for foreigners to buy, and that would make it more difficult for the U.S. to export its way out of trouble, a major part of Obama's plan for economic recovery.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
There are now more billionaires in the world than ever. According to Forbes magazine, the U.S. continues to have the most people with billion-dollar fortunes. Yet other countries are catching up, and they're not the countries you'd expect. From London, here's the BBC's Rebecca Singer.
With a $74 billion bank account, Mexican telecom tycoon Carlos Slim is the world's richest man for the second year running. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are clinging on to second and third place. But while the number of billionaires in the US continues to grow, American dominance is beginning to slip. Steve Forbes is editor-in-chief of the magazine.
The US share of global billionaires is on a downtrend. So while the U.S. is inching forward, parts of the world are just surging forward.
Countries like China, which has added 46 new billionaires in the last year alone. Indonesia has doubled its billionaire count to 14, with coal and tobacco making people big fortunes. And Russia, where Moscow is now home to more billionaires than any other city in the world. And one last nugget, there is six names on the list, including founder Mark Zuckerberg, who owe most of their fortunes to Facebook. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
Final bids are due today for the Orange County Register. That's a newspaper in suburban Los Angeles. The paper and its sister media companies are on the auction block. So if the sad reality is, Steve, that fewer people are buying newspapers,
yeah,
who in the world would want to buy a newspaper company? Mm. Let's get that story now from Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
Freedom Communications owns the Orange County Register, plus other papers and local TV stations. Private equity firms invested in it a few years ago and got wiped out. This time, it's hedge funds buying up newspaper companies like Freedom that are just emerging from bankruptcy.
None of these are huge investments because they've been able to buy the shares for literally pennies on a dollar in many cases.
That's media consultant Martin Langeveld. I asked him, what does a hedge fund want with newspaper companies?
The pessimistic view is that they simply think that they can multiply their investment a few times by pushing for these kind of corporate consolidations between the different companies that they have holdings in.
The optimistic view, he says, is that the hedge funds will invest in a transition to digital media. But even the traditional newspaper companies bidding on the OC Register would also expect to save money by cutting jobs. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Steve, how would you like to walk into a Crate and Barrel and find a couch named after you?
Oh, wow.
The Chio,
it would
perhaps.
Be the Chio. That would okay. Be the Chio couch. Yes, how nice.
Well, most people, I would think, would like such an honor. But if you are hotel operator Ian Schrager, the guy who is famous for turning hotel lobbies into urban lounges with all kinds of swanky couches, You would not like that honor at all. Crate & Barrel named their new white leather sofa Ian in honor of Schrager, and he has reportedly sent a cease and desist letter.
Not happy.
A source close to Mr. Schrager told the New York Post, in this case, imitation is not the best form of flattery.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, March 10th in Los Angeles. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. We talked earlier about the nation's trade deficit getting wider. The U.S. is buying way more than it sells to other countries, and there is one place we can see which direction global trade is going. That's at the airport. What destinations are most popular at the big airline hubs? Well, Greg Lindsay has a new book out called Aerotropolis, and it looks at how cities of the future could be built around big airports. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you define this as a city built around an airport. I thought airports were built around cities.
You know, a city around an airport is sort of an extreme case. That's what we're seeing in places like China, India, Dubai, the Middle East, where population growth is leading them to build entire cities from scratch. And, you know, in a truly global economy, if you have to put a city somewhere, you need to connect it to the rest of the world. And so, therefore, it sort of makes sense to them to build a city from scratch around an airport. Here in the United States and Europe, we think that airports are nuisances at best. But, you know, really, airports are our sort of connections to the world. And I think in a truly global economy, we need to do a better job of integrating them into the cities we have and make them into better places to live and work.
This, of course, is all dependent upon oil prices, which have been so volatile and on the increase, by the way, lately. If we're building a future around air travel, how's that going to jibe with the increasingly alarming oil picture that we have?
Air travel doesn't correspond to oil prices. It corresponds to GDP growth. So basically, the wealthier we become, the more we value our time, and that leads to increasing air travel. This is why China and India are posting 20% air travel growth rates, even though they're facing the same high oil prices. But, you know, in the long run, we have to develop liquid biofuels. I think there's no future in which we can sort of just continue to consume fossil fuels at the rate we're going, and you're never going to have an electric 747.
How is this going to shape the future of trade around the world?
You can really use air travel and air routes as a proxy for seeing how the world is connecting to itself. So, for example, the rise of Middle Eastern airlines like Emirates out of Dubai and Qatar Airways out of Doha, they've massively expanded into both China and Africa and sort of created this sort of hub that's become the sort of great crossroads for Chinese and African traders going in both directions. It's sort of a resurrection of the notion of the Silk Road that once bound China to the Roman Empire. So we're seeing sort of the economic geography around the world being reshaped by these new air routes and new airlines.
Greg Lindsay, author of Aerotropolis, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Well, from airplanes to trains, the Florida Department of Transportation has released a study showing that the proposed high-speed rail line between Tampa and Orlando would have had more than 3 million riders and would have made money in its first year. But as you remember, the governor of Florida turned down federal funds for the project. Let's bring in our economics correspondent, Chris Farrell, to dig into the issue of high-speed rail and its economic impact. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
So how important is high-speed rail for the economies of various regions in the country?
I think that high-speed rail is important in the short run because it will provide a lot of construction jobs. And in the long run, I think it's very important in a region because we have an aging infrastructure, we have increasing congestion, and Jeremy, I don't know if you noticed, but we also have a high price of oil.
Yeah.
So high-speed rail will help move people cheaper, faster, and easier.
But there's a lot of skepticism that remains. What is the cost of just leaving things the way that they are right now?
I think there are two major costs. If you look at our infrastructure, it's aging. Recent estimates, it's costing us $200 billion a year. If you look at things like trucks just sitting in traffic jams, so that's a long-term cost in terms of our bridges, our water, our energy. But the other part of it is we need to start dealing with creating a new infrastructure that really gets around this whole issue of congestion, and high-speed rail is part of it, unless you want to be building airports everywhere.
Now, there are 50 states in the country, Chris. Is there any state that you're looking at that's doing things right?
You know, I think there are a number of states that are doing things right. Denver's doing things right. In that city, Twin Cities here, we're building light rail. But let me highlight Virginia. The new governor, Bob McDonnell, borrowing $4 billion. And what he said is, look, interest rates are low. Our economy is weak. The cost of construction is down.
Right.
Now is the time to borrow and rebuild our roads. Bravo. He's doing the right thing. Contrast that with Governor Christie in New Jersey. He decided he didn't want to spend the $2.7 billion to improve the rail link between New Jersey and New York. And Jeremy, it's the wrong move for New Jersey because the growth of northern New Jersey really depends on the metropolitan area called New York City. It extends into Connecticut, extends into New Jersey. And so workers could go back and forth with ease and safely.
Two Republican governors doing two very different things when it comes to infrastructure. Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And finally, Jeremy, the Center for Responsive Politics has figured out how much money newly elected members of Congress have. Their wealth, right? The wealthiest member is Connecticut freshman Senate Democrat Richard Blumenthal, just elected back in November.
Right.
He's worth an estimated $95 million.
Wow.
Yeah. On the other end of the spectrum, newly elected Representative Joe Walsh, the Republican congressman from Illinois. Not the other guy.
Not the guy from the Eagles.
No, not him.
No.
Joe Walsh has a net worth of negative $317,498.
Wow. Is that a net loss?
Yeah. The Tea Party favorite lost his condo in a foreclosure a couple years back, but he says he wears the distinction. This is what he's talking about here. He wears the distinction of being the poorest member of Congress as a badge of honor.
I wonder if he can get his coworkers to take him out for a bite to eat in that case.
Maybe so. After a tough day on Capitol Hill.
That's right.
Absolutely. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.